TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Race, gender, and class struggle. Discussion of racism is usually a discussion about personal attitudes, not of the larger system of power that sustains and feeds institutional and systemic racism and sexism. Racism and sexism have historically served a number of real functions. For example, they have created a surplus workforce, and they have divided those who find themselves at the bottom of the social power structure. In this talk, Michael Parenti asks the important question, how were racism and sexism used by employers, the police, colonial powers, and even the CIA to maintain the existing order? Michael Parenti is an internationally known lecturer and the author of 19 books. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. He gave this lecture in April of 2006 in Arcata, California. Here is Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Some of us even got in here dry, didn't you? Well, that's good. We have this trinity of race, gender, and class, and it's sort of treated like a trinity, and I don't want to treat it that way tonight. I think there's nothing wrong with looking at race, gender, and class as distinct from each other, of course, because there are different dynamics, different historical developments, different imperatives involved that are distinct from each other. In many respects, they are. The mistake is to consider these three things as unconnected and always mutually exclusive. In regard to many issues, they are interrelated and part of the same overall systemic dynamic. And I want to start by focusing on class, because there are two ways of looking at class. One way is in race, gender, and class. A demographic trait, like gender is a demographic trait, and race is a demographic trait, and so is class. That means your status, your income, your profession, lifestyle, that sort of thing. There's another way of looking at class, and that's why the title of this talk isn't race, gender, and class. It's race, gender, and class struggle. And that is, class is the only one of the three which you cannot hope for any equality. You can't have classes and have equality. By definition, they're unequal to each other. You can hopefully have and achieve gender equality, which we haven't. You can hopefully achieve racial equality, which we haven't. But you most certainly cannot achieve class equality except by having a classless situation, by eliminating it as the actual dynamic or category. So class is a relationship. It's an interrelationship. You can't have one class without having another. You can't have plutocrats and bourgeois capitalists without having workers and employees. You can't have slaveholders without having slaves. You can't have feudal lords without having serfs. That just about covers all class societies that we've had in history. More than that, the interrelationship involves a relationship to a third factor, which is the material substance and wealth of society, the means of production. One group owns the mines, the factories, the farms, the houses, the land, the newspapers, the media, etc., etc., etc. And the other group has nothing to sell but its labor to the first one. I remember doing backup strike support work in Carbondale, Illinois. I was in Urbana. We went down for one day to Carbondale, and one of the auto worker strikers was African American, and he put it very succinctly. He said, He said, either you own the mother or you work for it. That was it. Either you own the mother or you work for it. He used a somewhat longer word than mother, but that was it. So, and what we're talking about when we're talking about ownership and class struggle and class power in this society, we're talking about these gigantic multi-billion dollar transnational corporations. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about mom and pop enterprises. I want to make that point because it often comes up in discussions when capitalism is being discussed. There's invariably someone who says, what about the entrepreneurial spirit? What about the mom and pop enterprise, the small business where people struggle and they develop a little business and they hire a few other people and create more jobs? Usually described in that sentimental sing-song voice, and you have more jobs, and then maybe they open up a second little place. And all. And I always answer, I'm not talking about those places. I'm not talking about mom and pop, little businesses. Little businesses isn't what this is about. The wealth, the power, the thrust of it all is very simply in the hands of transnational corporations. Small businesses are the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And squirrels that dance among elephants have a very low life expectancy. And 600 small businesses go under every week in America. And when they go under, unlike Chrysler, unlike Illinois Bank, unlike McDonnell Aircraft, unlike Boeing, unlike any number of other mass multinational corporations, they don't get bailed out. They go under. You're on your own. And they don't count in the power relation. They count in the economy. In fact, almost all job growth in this economy comes from small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and public service. The net growth in new jobs among the big corporations, of course they're creating new jobs, and that's the Walmarts and McDonald's. But if you count what General Motors is doing, they're closing the factories, the better paid jobs, and outsourcing. You can't bring in their outsourcing and their downsizing and all that stuff. The net number of jobs they create every year is zero. So all that growth comes from middle and small business. So I'm not dismissing small businesses. We're not talking about small capital. We're talking about class struggle and multinational corporate capitalism. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay. We're also talking about wealth. And when you talk about wealth, you should also talk about poverty. Because wealth and poverty not only coexist, there's a dynamic interrelationship between the two of them. We often hear that this is such an unfortunate and juxtaposition. So much wealth and right next to so much poverty. Oh, you go to Rio and you can see all this wealth, these luxury hotels, and right behind them, all those terrible shanty towns. Isn't that terrible? What they don't understand is those shanty towns are supporting that luxury. That wealth creates that poverty. You can't have wealth without poverty. You can't have rich slave owners living in magnificent opulence as they did in the Roman Empire, as I described it in the book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. You can't have that unless you have slaves who are creating that value and working, and consuming a very small portion of the value they create. That's how we expropriate. That's how we get rich. We take, it's an upward redistribution from those who work to those who don't, for the most part. You can't have lords living in the manor born to the manor born. Well, some of them work, but they're not creating their wealth. I mean, Rupert Murdoch works. He's not creating his billions of dollars. I mean, he can go in his office and be busy. David Rockefeller can go in and be busy if he wants and have three secretaries and all. That's not, he'll walk into here, into this room, and when he leaves, he's richer than when he walked in. He made more money in that time than you made all in a week or a year. Yeah. Well, most of you are unemployed. I can see that already. I mean, we're loading the case here. We shouldn't do that. In fairness to poor David Rockefeller. Okay. There's a constant redistribution of wealth from those who produce it to those who own the production facilities. Now, this upward redistribution takes place in other ways, too. I mean, that's the Marxist paradigm, but, you know, that's not all there is to it. For instance, you can say, well, I'm not exploited then because I work for a non-profit. You know, they're not expropriating my labor in that way. Well, you are, because don't forget you're still a taxpayer and you get terribly exploited that way. One of the greatest sources of profit accumulation is the U.S. Treasury in this country. The return, the most profitable forms of investment are through the U.S. Treasury. You're a pharmaceutical and you go out there and you just give $5,000 to this congressman, $5,000 to that one, $10,000 to that senator, another $30,000 to the Republican National Committee, this and that. And they pass a Medicare prescription bill that's going to give your industry $1 trillion in business. That's coming right out of the hides of us taxpayers. That great deficit, that huge deficit that Bush keeps running up, that's an upward redistribution of income from the people who pay the taxes to the people who are lending the money to the government. The government is borrowing money from the people they should be taxing, and they're cutting the taxes of those people. And the greater that deficit goes, the less you get back on your tax dollar. The larger the chunk of that dollar is just going to rich creditors. And that's the whole idea. That's one of the basic ideas behind deficit spending. That's why the conservatives pursue it with such alacrity. Let's discuss racism. Discussions of racism usually fix upon attitudes. Because one of the things American intellectuals do is they manage never to ground anything in material interests or in the social structure as such. Things just float around and they talk about them and they write articles about it and all that sort of thing. And we hear that racism is a kind of a bad thing. And we have presidents of the United States. Bill Clinton in his last year in office, remember he started that thing about, well, I'm going to investigate racism. And he had that highly publicized thing where he sat down with black families and white families. And said, now, why can't we all get together and learn to hug and love each other and all that sort of thing? We should keep in mind that it's not just a matter of cleansing hearts and minds. We should keep in mind the larger system of power and interest that sustains racist attitudes. That's why we should speak not only of attitudinal racism, but also of institutional racism and systemic racism. That the system, the structure itself, preordains or feeds and necessitates and is advantaged by these kinds of attitudes. For instance, in modern-day capitalist society, racism and sexism have historically served a number of very real systemic functions. First of all, employers have always desired a surplus workforce. When there's full employment, when jobs are looking for workers rather than workers are looking for jobs, then wages go up. When it's the other way around, when it's workers looking for jobs and there's more workers than jobs, then wages are depressed and they come down. And one way you depress wages and keep them down is by lowering the wage floor, keeping that as low as you can. And what you do there is you try to have a super exploited portion of an already exploited labor pool. The super exploited portion will be made up of disadvantaged people. People who are disadvantaged because of other dynamics maybe in society, like sexism and racism, for instance. And traditionally, this reserve army of labor that helps suppress the labor wages is made up of women, children, immigrants, and ethnic minorities. And what made, in many places, what made that particular group employable, what made women employable in late 19th century industrialization, was their quote willingness, I heavily quote willingness because willingness denotes choice almost, but given the horrible necessities, they're forced necessity to go work at a lower wage. If women started demanding the same wages as men did, they'd go and hire men. The other thing it was thought, of course, was that women and children were malleable and less troublesome. They're less likely to throw a wrench in the machine, less likely to punch out the foreman, and immigrants also were more vulnerable. Many of them were illegal. They couldn't voice grievances. Still true. They with linguistic problems, they couldn't organize that well. Okay. Racism and sexism also serve class power as a divisive force. They help keep the working class fragmented and disorganized, fighting against each other for crumbs rather than concerting for a larger slice of the pie. Beating your wife instead of organizing to beat your boss. Economic elites seem well aware of this. They consciously discourage working class unity and they consciously incite inter-ethnic competition. This is an old thing, by the way. This is not some little analysis I'm kind of digging up or making up. You can go back and read Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle, Politics, Book 1, I remember, I think it was. He actually advises the landowner and slaveholders. He said, in your work gangs, meaning your slave gangs, have slaves of different nationalities and different tongues so that they can't understand each other and they are therefore less likely to concert in the pursuit of dangerous novelties, I think was the phrasing in Politics. Let's fast forward from ancient Greece, 400, 500 BC, to the last century, the oil companies and coal mining companies in America. They would deliberately pursue this policy. They'd hire a Swede, a Hungarian, an Italian, a Pole, and have them all work together. They couldn't understand each other. Not that they had read Aristotle, but they were ruling elites who were facing the same opportunities of manipulation and conjuring up divisiveness. In the 1600s in North America, in the 1600s, before there were the laws and the ideologies of slavery and racism, before they had been really well developed, you had white indentured servants and black slaves not only worked together, but they lived under the same hard conditions and they fraternized together and sometimes they even intermarried. You know, why did the South and why did the states in this country until as late as what, 1967 was the last miscegenation law finally removed from the books. Why did they have miscegenation laws? They were outlawing intermarriage. Why did they have to actually use the force of the state to outlaw intermarriage? Because people intermarried. It was a problem. They had to teach. They had to teach people racism. They had to instruct them and command them into their racism. It was the same way with anti-Semitism, how it had to be taught to the European peasantry by the lords and bishops of Europe for 1,000 years. You know, though, for years, the peasant had a problem with the demonized Jew. The description didn't fit his friend Moish up the hill, who was a fellow farmer who helped him pull a cow out of the mud and who he worked with. Christians actually attended Jewish ceremonies. Jews actually presided over Christian meetings in the early first millennia. And the peasants had to learn. They learned slowly, but they did learn. And eventually they learned to channelize their legitimate grievances and anger away from their lords and toward irrelevant and innocent enemies. And so we had the same thing in America, where slaveholders and land grabbers endured a lively fear that indentured white servants would join with blacks or Native American Indians against the property class, as happened more than once, by the way. It did happen. Not a very highly publicized part of American history, colonial history. So the colonial governments pursued a conscious policy of creating aversions and segregations between the three racial groups, turning Indians against blacks and poor whites against both. Fast forward again, U.S. prisons back in the 60s, 70s, right down to this day, have consciously promoted friction between white, black, and Latino gangs. Back in the early 70s, I remember a case, I think it was in Oregon or Washington State, I can't remember now, a politically conscious prisoner by the name of Stephen Kessler. All sorts of charges were put on him. He was harassed for his politics and his organizing in the prison. And one of the charges against him was fomenting racial unity in prison. I rest my case. There it is. The same strategies of divide and conquer have been used by urban police forces in regard to street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods in L.A., generations of racial segregation in the U.S. and South Africa have had the effect of setting white workers against black, competing for the scraps off the table. And the more successfully segregated the society, the more successfully suppressed were the unions because of the race issue in the South, the lower were the wages. It's no accident that wages were lowest in the South. It's no accident that unions were weakest in the South. That was the place where this policy of institutionalized racism was pursued with a vigor and a totality that makes your skin crawl. Inciting racial divisiveness has been a standard policy of imperialists for hundreds of years. The North American colonizers and European colonizers of Latin America and Africa and Asia very consistently played off people against people, tribe against tribe, bribing some, giving arms to another, spreading rumors around, creating incidents, murdering some people in one group and blaming it on the people in the other group and the like. The Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire played different nationalities against each other. The CIA incited the Hmong tribal people in Vietnam and played on tribal rivalries in Angola, where they supported Zavimbi and his UNITA for 25 years and 2 million deaths in Angola. And the CIA showed a sudden and equally hypocritical compassion for the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua during the Sandinista reign. Yugoslavia was mentioned. It's a dramatic example of Western intelligence forces egging on and supporting with guns, huge sums of money, and organizational and military assistance, the most retrograde secessionist elements in Croatia. In Croatia, they promoted a leader named Franz Tuđman, who was an out-and-out fascist, who was part of the Ustasi, who were open, total collaborators, Croatian Nazis, who collaborated with the German Nazis in World War II. In Bosnia, they supported Izetbegović. Izetbegović had been in his youth a member of the Hitler SS, the Muslim SS, whose job was bringing and conveying victims of the concentration camps of the Holocaust, including Jews, Serbs, and Roma, known to us as Gypsies, down to the Jasenovac concentration camp, where they were killed under unspeakable conditions. Unspeakable, worse than what the SS did anywhere else. I don't want to go into details. I'm on the advisory board of the Jasenovac Foundation, and there's a literature very poorly circulated, but it's around, and it's a story that needs to be told. These were the people that the U.S. and Bill Clinton and the White House and the media and the CIA were backing. And unfortunately, there were progressives in our own ranks who on this war stood shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House. The same people who wonder why those rednecks back Bush on Iraq were backing Clinton on Yugoslavia with his 78 days of bombing. And he took a country that was prosperous, where 80% of the economy was publicly owned, and broke that up into a bunch of little right-wing republics now, where everything has been privatized, everything has been deregulated, unemployment is up, the fastest growing profession is prostitution, and the whole economy is being sold off at garage sale prices. Yugoslavia was a self-defining, prosperous social democracy. It was tolerated during the Cold War when there was a Soviet Union behind it. It no longer had to be tolerated right there in the middle of Europe. It refused to become a client state to corporate globalism. It did not open up its markets to multi-corporate completely. I mean, in Belgrade, and you could see, you know, Hilton Hotel and all that. There was some of that there, but most of the economy was still publicly owned. It refused to join the European Union. It showed no interest in joining NATO, and it was done in. By the way, another group the U.S. supported in that war was the Albanian KLA, which the U.S. State Department had called a terrorist organization just 2 years before. One of the first victims of the KLA were other Albanians who were Federalists who did not want secession and the like. They also pointed out that the KLA was linked to a group called Al-Qaeda and were linked to the Chechnya terrorists. And Kosovo now has been cleansed. It has been cleansed of Serbs, Jews, Gorani, Egyptians, Roma, and all these people.
That was the first part of a one-hour lecture on race, gender, and class struggle by Michael Parenti. With roots in a working-class Italian neighborhood in New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer and author. The Assassination of Julius Caesar, The Culture Struggle, and Super Patriotism are his most recent books. For more information, visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org. You can also visit TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for a link to Parenti's website. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape or a film on DVD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call. TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Race, Gender, and Class Struggle. This is the second part of a one-hour-long talk given in April 2006 by Michael Parenti. Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts and a highly respected author. In part one, Michael Parenti had explained how race, gender, and class are interrelated and part of a systemic dynamic. Racism and sexism are used and abused and often prevent unity among those who find themselves at the bottom of the social power structure. Parenti explains that racism and sexism can't be overcome unless we understand what role they play in a class-based society. Here is Michael Parenti.
Much of politics, ladies and gentlemen, much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. So racist emotions and fear and resentment may be irrational emotions. They may have irrational imagery and the like, but they are often rationally manipulated and pursued. Historically, racism comes from two great class exploitative forces. One is slavery. No slaveocracy rules nakedly. No ruling class of any kind rules nakedly. They all, whether it's the Chinese landlord class or the feudal class in Europe or ancient slaveocracies or the American antebellum slaveocracy or the ruling plutocratic class today, they all build up an ideology to justify their rule. The Chinese landlords used to say, the sun cannot rise in the west. This is what they told the peasants. That meant you can no more change position with me or equalize our positions than the sun can rise in the west. Don't ask for the impossible. So they represented their very privileged and very exploitative and unjust system as the natural order of society, you see. In the U.S., slaveocracy developed religion. The clergy were actively involved, not just in the South, in the North too. Many clergy involved in justifying slavery. The slaves, you know, were the descendants of Ham. Ham was dark, if you remember, read the Bible. He was dark, and all his children, therefore, shall be the hewers of wood and drawers of water. The colleges in the North were prohibited from discussing and pursuing and advocating abolitionism. The intellectuals and professors in Southern colleges full-time pursuing justifications for slavery and why it was building up a whole science and anthropology and sociology and psychology as to why slavery was a just natural thing, because the slave was lazy, shiftless, this and that. There were psychiatrists in America who studied a very real mental illness that existed at this time. It doesn't exist anymore, and it afflicted only slaves. It was called drapetomania, and it was the irresistible impulse that possessed some slaves to abscond from service, was the term, to run away. And this was an illness that slaves suffered from. Eminent doctor, the Samuel Cartwright himself. I have a quote in my book, The Culture Struggle, and he talks about this. He says, drapetomania is a mental illness like any other, and there are cures for it. The cures consisted of ferocious applications of the bullwhip and branding on the face and chains and, in some extreme cases, castration. Those were the cures. These were the best minds of science in the early 19th century, giving us what to do about this. Another source of racism is imperialism. The imperialists are not out to conquer other people simply because they're not white or they're of a different ethnic group. They don't care. The imperialists don't care what color you are. They're very democratic in who they kill. I mean, I used to hear when they were bombing Vietnam, they said they would never bomb Europe. Well, and what happened in Yugoslavia? They were bombing Europe. We saw countries bombing right in the heart of Europe. This is 40 years after World War II, when we thought all that was over, that was passed on a stage of history. They bomb, they'll kill anybody, they'll kill their own mothers if they can get more. They're not interested in the color line, they're interested in the bottom line. The first victims of Western European imperialism were Eastern Europeans, who were Caucasians. The oldest colony that the English ever built, and one they still have a piece of, was Ireland. And you can't get any more pink-faced and fair-faced than the Irish are. But when they went into Latin America, and Africa and Asia, it was for what was in that land. They went in for the tin, the copper, the manganese, the bauxite, the oil. Let me repeat that one. The oil, the iron, silver, the gold, the cotton, the hemp, the tobacco, the rum. You can name it, go on and on. The foods, just the foods, and the labor. The Roman Empire, the Romans were big on that one. That one of the reasons you conquered a country was for the labor. Because that labor, that human labor creates wealth for you. Slaves. Or if not slaves, certainly exploited labor. But after you're in there a while, you got to justify it. See, if I come in and I slaughter your herds and burn your crops and destroy your mines and burn down your well-built buildings, I can give you descriptions of that. French military in North Africa admiring these buildings of various tribes they had to burn down and the like and kill. And I enslave your men in the mines and rape your women and spit your babies on bayonets or whatever all the various atrocities are. I have to, after a while, justify it. And what I say is, well, they're animals. I do what every ruling class, every murderous class has ever done in history. I reverse the role of victim and victimizer. I talk about, look at the literature in America about the Native American Indians. Fierce red devils, ferocious, cutthroating, scalping. Scalping was an European Caucasian innovation. The Indians learned it from the white man. But you go on, talk about how the only good engine is a dead engine. They're horrible creatures. They're animals. So you start developing this, again, mythology of these wretched subhuman people who you by necessity need to do in. You see that with gender also. Women have been subjected to the oppressions of men for mere, 5 million years, whatever it is. And of course, there builds up the view of women as a liability. They're fickle, they're silly, they're lightheaded, they're superficial, they're... what?
Needy, clingy,
treacherous. And if you get into Christianity, they're worse. They're seductress, and they are the purveyors of evil. Who gave Adam that apple, huh? By the way, it wasn't an apple. Read the Bible, there's no apple. It was a fruit. Although apple was a generic term. But I'm digressing, let's get back to it. The Jezebel, the woman is Jezebel. That's another big theme and all that sort of thing. I deal with that in the culture struggle. Custom against women, I have two chapters in there. That sort of thing goes on. Now, conservatives in modern day America, I think, I've consciously cultivated these race and gender issues and other what they call culture issues as a way of distracting people from looking at bread and butter issues, that is, class struggle issues. I actually saw a Sunday afternoon show. It was William Buckley and some of his other, you know, the whole bunch of these right-wing pundits who overpopulate the TV channels. And they were talking about this. How do we get Joe Sixpack and Middle America to come on over to our side and we should consciously pursue these culture issues? You know, it was interesting. They didn't say it all. They didn't say, look, we're ripping them off and we're getting our tax cuts for the super rich and they're paying most of it and they're a bunch of suckers, but we got to justify it and distract them. They didn't use the word distract, but say bring to their attention these kind of things. Family values. Well, we should talk more family values. Family values are important to the working Joe. For instance, abortion. There's an important gender right. Conservatives used to be for abortion. Ronald Reagan signed one of the most liberal abortion bills up to that point in American history when he was governor of this state. George Bush Sr., George I, when he was in Congress, voted for abortion bills. They were for abortion. They thought the poor had too many babies. They would go on welfare, all this deadwood on our economy and this and that. And abortion is a good solution. It was only that when they realized that abortion could be an issue that could split the traditionally Catholic Democratic vote and also mobilize and ignite some rural, low-income Protestant fundamentalist vote. It had an emotive effect to it and all that. That they began to argue that a fertilized ovum was a human being who had priorities over the mature human being that was carrying this fertilized ovum. Other issues, of course, gay rights, gay marriage. I mean, that was like throwing red meat at them just before the 2004 election. Isn't that right? That suddenly gay marriage became the issue there. And the most persistent one was family values. Again and again, the family value hypocrites, you know. You had Phil Graham, who dumped his wife and ran off with his secretary, talking about family values. You had Newt Gingrich, who, when his wife was lying in bed with cancer, almost dying, coming in with the divorce papers and having her sign the divorce papers in the hospital. Late 80s, you remember this, where these a number of congressmen, family value guys, it was discovered, had been cavorting with male prostitutes, had been bringing male prostitutes up to Capitol Hill and buying their services. Male prostitutes. I mean, when I read that, I just was so shocked and disgusted and just fed up with it. It really lowered my opinion of male prostitutes. Well, who are hard-working guys, hey? Well, aside from ethnic divisions, we should note there are cases, there have been cases, even in recent years, where there has been ethnic and gender unity in labor struggles. And that means this came in the crucible of class struggle. The labor struggles in recent years, for instance, you've had African Americans, Latinos, Asians, Filipinos, white workers, male and female, standing shoulder to shoulder in major strikes by steel workers, coal miners, dock workers, teachers, hospital employees. Those are the ones that I was able to get down, and I'm sure there are others too. Let me tell you something else about the class divide and how it's seldom noticed because we concentrate exclusively on race and gender. Blue-collar workers, regardless of race, are 2.3 times more likely to die of heart disease than managers and professionals. In contrast, black males are only 1.2 times more likely, only. But I mean, that's a terrible, but it's less. In other words, class is a greater divide. Lower-income people of whatever race and gender are more likely to report poor health than upper-income people of whatever race and gender. In other words, the morbidity rates have to be explained by looking at class as well as race and gender. But the U.S. government collects data only on race and gender while ignoring class. And now I want to point out that this negligence is not indicative of a lack of class awareness, but of a keen sense of class, a sense of keeping it off the agenda and out of our consciousness. And that is why they will not discuss class. And those who do discuss class, even among many who pretend to be on the left, those who do discuss class, these many who pretend to be on the left, get very nervous and very labeling and very uncomfortable. It's happened to me in much of my career, and I'm not talking about the William Buckleys. I'm talking about allegedly progressive people. I remember all along, all the way up when I was doing this stuff, people quick to label me a Marxist. Are you a Marxist? And, I said, if I was sure you understood what you meant by that word, the same as I understood what I mean by it, then I would say yes. But since I'm not sure, I'd have to say, I don't know, and neither do you, really. You don't know what that means. And I would... I would write something on... I'd talk about the police. I say, the police are not neutral. They do not... they don't just keep law and order. They have that function, too. But they have a class function. They support the the big property on the factory against the workers. Why are they protecting the factory? Why aren't they helping the workers go into the factory? It's if there's a lockout, let's say, in violation of a contract and all that. And people say, oh, well, that's Marx. Isn't that Marx? That's Marx. Or I'd say, you know, I don't think the U.S. is really promoting democracy abroad and giving aid and all. I think they're going in and they're doing this and exploiting and I'm talking about imperialism. And I say, oh, that's Marx. That's Marx. And I'd say, you know, I think race is not just a matter of attitude. It's, you know, some of the things I say here and then this and this. And they'd say, that sounds a little, that's Marx. That's Marx. And after a while, I started thinking, oh, this guy Marx is pretty good, you know. Here I am busting my back trying to come up with an analysis, and every time I do, they give him the credit, you know. And he's been dead 120 years or something. The courts, too. The courts ignore class and consider only race and gender as categories for equal treatment under the law. And why? Because of what I said before. You can't have equality in class. Were they to have equality of class under the law, this would have revolutionary implications. Whereas with race and gender, they can finesse. They can bring in people. They can elect black mayors. Or they can appoint black secretaries of states. They can bring in women into office. But what blacks? What women? What women? Lynn Cheney, Jean Kirkpatrick, and just after we're just recovering from Jean Kirkpatrick, we get Madeleine Albright, just recovering from her, and we get Condoleezza Rice, mamma mia. I mean, this is, and who satisfies two categories of identity politics. She's black, and she's a female. And you find that they can still perform the same class supremacy functions as any white male can. By the way, I'm not saying that having women on the Supreme Court, having women in high positions of government is a totally immaterial thing. That's a good advance, but it's a very misleading concession. It's used opportunistically. It's harnessed by those whose real concern, after all, is again not the color line but the bottom line. Let me close here by telling you about the study that Robert Cole was doing. Robert Cole, Harvard psychologist, he was interviewing black people in communities and white people. And he found that many ordinary African Americans had a sense of not only class, but of class power. He found that many working class women doing two shifts at Walmarts and living out of a van have a sense of class exploitation and class struggle. Cole's African-American respondents would ask him if he also had interviewed the rich folks. And Cole said, you mean the white folks, not the rich folks, right? And they said, no, we mean, quote, the rich, the ones who decide how the poor folks live. To Cole's credit, this is his own account, to his credit, I'll say that. He's showing his readers what a dense head he is on the class issue, as every Harvard professor pretty much is, almost. not to mention Yale and Princeton. One African-American lawyer told Cole that if he wanted to know why black people live the way they do, he should talk not to the ordinary working-class white people, who were also victimized, but to the affluent and powerful ones who own the farmlands and the factories. I quote this lawyer, they own everything, and they decide what happens in this city and in all the other cities, unquote. Now, it gets even more interesting. Cole found surprisingly similar opinions among working class whites. They, too, railed against the rich, or the big shots with plenty of money and all the power they want. So what you had here was these interviewees, working class African Americans, working class whites, were introducing the famous Harvard professor to the concept not of class, but of class power. They were taking him to school about something that academics and intellectuals have systematically programmed out of their perception. He interviewed working class people, and he didn't ask them about class or class power. Isn't that kind of extraordinary? That's an extraordinary achievement when you think about it. But it's not so extraordinary that you don't get tenure at some of these places if you're going to be doing that Marx stuff, you see. So in sum, we don't have a full understanding of the functional imperatives of racism and sexism unless we take into account the political economic context, the class power structure. Unless we move from attitudinal racism and sexism to institutional and systemic analyses. I'm not arguing that you can reduce all of racism and sexism to the analysis I gave you today. I do believe there are imperatives, historical and whatever else, which develop their own momentum and have their own connections. You see that especially in the case of gender. But even there, you know, even there, a society where you have education available for women, entry into decent job markets for women, human services to support them and their children or to back them up and give them some kind of backup. In those societies, women have a better chance against male oppression than they do in Pakistan or Afghanistan or other places like that, where women have no system. So systemic factors can come in even in that historic oppression of men over women like that. I welcome identity politics and the vital war that's waged against racism, sexism, and homophobia. But you know, it's been 35 years where identity politics has been used as an excuse, as a means to deny confronting the political economic realities of reactionary class power that is slamming us in the head all the time, that preys upon us ever more viciously and openly. The failure to perceive racial and gender oppression within the context of class power oppression leads to what I call the competition of oppressions. I remember also one time in Washington, D.C., at a meeting, a guy getting up, a black man, and she says, "Yeah, you may be a woman, but you're white, and you don't know what I have to deal with." And she says, "Yeah, well, you may be black, but you're a man, and you don't know what I have to deal with." And another woman gets up and says, "Yeah, well, neither of you know what it means to be a lesbian. If I went in and to an employer and announced I was a lesbian, you guys would get the job far ahead of me." So there they all, and I got up and said, what is this? What are we doing here? It's the competition for oppressions, which is, I'm more oppressed than you, which means, first of all, I feel my oppression more than you are going to feel it, and you have no empathy for it. But also, it means that mine is more urgent, and we should be giving our limited resources to this struggle. That's what happens when you treat this Holy Trinity as mutually exclusive and in competition with each other, rather than seeing that the people who are giving you homophobia and the outlawing of gay marriage and the people who are outlawing abortions and the people who are giving us racism and the people are the same people who are bombing Iraq and giving these tax cuts to that top fraction of 1%, and the same people who are doing all these other things and rolling back all the social democratic gains of the 20th century that took generations of struggle. Those are the same people. And once we see that, then we're on a better track, I think. Let me close with a little story, which is a true story. When the committees of correspondence were forming in 1992, they had their founding convention in Berkeley, California, where I had just moved to Berkeley that year, and it was just a 20-minute walk away up on the Cal campus, so I went up there and I attended and I saw a lot of people I knew and all that, and there was a conference, and they were setting up, this is the founding conference. I never did join, but I was observing anyway, and they were setting up the statements of intentions and their standards, you know, and their goals and all that. And some guy got the microphone on the floor and he said, "There's nothing in our charter here about gay rights. You put something in, please, gay rights." And people up on the stage did. "Gay and lesbian rights." And they said, "Oh, right, gay, lesbian rights." Then another guy got up And transgender and transsexual had not yet quite come into vogue. That was a few years down the line. But he said, no, it should be gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights, because we bisexuals run into discrimination from both communities, he said. Versatile little rascal that he was. So there he was. So they said, yes, that's right. Gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights. And I was sitting back there, and there was this old lefty trade unionist sitting behind me, and I hear him say, he said it just loud enough for people around him, he says, yeah, and how about putting something in there for the people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work? And brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, that's who I speak for, the people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work, which, by the way, also includes any number of gays, lesbians, bisexual, African-American, Latinos, everybody else. Okay, thank you very much.
This was the second half of a one-hour program on race, gender, and class struggle by Michael Parenti. With roots in a working-class Italian neighborhood in New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. He is the author of 19 books, among them The Assassination of Julius Caesar, History as Mystery, and Democracy for the Few. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape or a film on DVD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.